Okay, welcome back. Some time ago, I don't know how many weeks now, not that many weeks ago, we had a gentleman on, we'll just call him John, and we learned more about DARPA in his two visits than I have in 20 years, 22 years of doing the program. I've asked him to come back on, and he said he'd be happy to, and he is here tonight. He's standing by. John, are you there?
Yes, I am, sir.
Thank you for being here. We had a great two conversations, just extraordinary amount of information. Did you get any feedback or any rumblings about that visit or two you made here?
No, nothing that would pop up anything. As you know, John's not my real name, and also at the same time, I don't have anything that I'm publicizing, a website, a book,
sure,
or anything.
No, you got no access to Grind. What you did was offer information that came basically from 10 years ago when you were invited to a very high-level meeting of DARPA, and I think you were invited more of a compliment on your innate intelligence. You're obviously a very gifted man, and they wanted you there. It was an interesting circumstance.
Well, yeah, it very much was. At the time I was invited, and I don't want to go too much into the circumstances, it was part of a very broad reach effort that DARPA seems to do from time to time. They don't classify it necessarily top secret, but they don't go out of their way to publicize any of this either.
Right.
And they bring in experts from inside and outside of the military and defense establishment, DARPA itself, and depending on what their focus is, and they prepare spectacularly run conferences to kind of develop policy goals. And like in the case that we were working on, it was a petroleum-free military. And at that point, they look at what they might need in terms of inventing things, what they already have, what types of changes to the organization or equipment would be necessary to take advantage of a shift, etc. And, you know, for me, quite a lot of what was revealed at the conference was surprising. And, you know, we'll recap some of it, but I know your audience would likely, some of them would find it surprising, and the others will say, I knew it. And that information generally, one of the reasons I've come forth is to provide people who are investigating these things the understanding that they're on the right track. This isn't just the fevered imaginings of conspiracy writers, as has often been portrayed.
Okay, so let's take a look. Let's back off and look at the bigger picture. Where is DARPA today in terms of leadership, cutting-edge technology, and where is DARPA taking us? And then finally, who's in control of DARPA?
Well, I'm not an...
Any order you want.
Well, the best people probably to answer those questions would be people who are actually in DARPA.
In DARPA, sure.
As opposed to myself. But what I learned at the time, and I don't think any of this will have changed, is it's a broad agency that has tendrils pretty much in everything, from deep in the Pentagon to various private sector company research establishments that it works within its funding, to the major, what you would call the major defense insiders. If your listeners were to go look up LMI, you can find the website lmi.org, Raytheon, the Rockwell Skunk Works, a lot of funded programs at MIT, all of the big defense insiders, the manufacturing companies, plus the various national laboratories, JPL, Los Alamos, Surface Weapons Lab from the Navy, which does a lot more than work on weapons that are weapons or surface. It does quite a lot of high-tech work. So people don't realize, just like the CIA, how widespread DARPA is, and many of its involvements are direct and indirect.
Sure.
And what surprised me is to see quite how deeply the various tendrils penetrate what we would think of as the private sector. Companies
now,
this is
interesting, because we always think basically in terms of black and white, government and private. But you're saying there really is no dividing line, not much anyway.
not the way you would think, because mm-hmm. quite a lot of these organizations, like say LMI, it's technically a private sector company, but its primary and only apparent customer mm-hmm. that I could figure out was the federal government. And an example would be this: you'd have an officer at the Pentagon who's well placed and capable in their job. And what they do is they assign them over to LMI. They're on paper carried on at the Pentagon's personnel and whatever department they're working in. But their day job, they show up at LMI, usually in uniform, mm-hmm. get paid by the Pentagon, and they work for LMI. And they bridge contacts, act as liaison officers, share their expertise, get developed by LMI. When they retire, because this is usually an end of career assignment, what they do is they just transition to be a full-time LMI employee. They take off their uniform.
I see.
Their pay increases sometimes mm-hmm. quite substantially,
mm-hmm.
and now they're officially a civilian, and they maintain their contacts and the like. So in a lot of ways, people could argue the negative is it's very incestuous. On the plus side, what you have is the closest intercooperation between the defense establishment and the, you know, public and private sector that you can find. And there's different arguments as to whether that's necessarily good or bad, but it did surprise me, you know, talking to individuals in side conversations, just how big this was and how many of their career plans for themselves and their financial plans, et cetera, stemmed
mm-hmm.
around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. Okay, so where would you place DARPA? Let's look at the pyramid that is the formerly United States. Where would DARPA be? Would that be the eye at the top? Where are they? Technologically, there's nobody higher. Go ahead.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that. DARPA seems mainly to be coordinating the development and or accessing of advanced technologies for the military
right.
in accord with policy goals. And
right.
my understanding from being there and information that was revealed frequently in side conversations
uh-huh.
was that there's quite a lot of existing technologies that are more advanced than they're given credit for. Some need to be developed. Others they have on the shelf waiting, black shelved in terms of patents that have been shut down or classified, et cetera. That was
uh-huh.
that was the big surprise to me. I wouldn't say they're at the top in terms of this grand organization. They do seem to be towards the top, and kind of, like I said, they would bridge. I've seen these various pyramid charts alleging, you know, the Illuminati organization, corporation, government leaders, et cetera. It would look like it would mm-hmm. be in the top third, bridging those types of organization charts and bringing those organizations together.
Okay.
But I don't think it's got a fixed role because you get deep into, say, what they would call Area 51 or Los Alamos or a project.
Right.
Sometimes they stumble across these technological breakthroughs or have orphan projects, and they don't know quite where to put it. DARPA, I think, brings all of this stuff together so that they can say, okay, now what are we going to do policy-wise? What are we going to need to invent? What are we going to access in terms of making a weapon system? And an example of a project that I know went up and down
mm-hmm.
is this giant airlift using dirigibles,
mm-hmm.
you know, the old-fashioned Hindenburg idea.
Right,
But a helium-based dirigible for heavy lift that would just be faster than ship and hopefully less vulnerable
uh-huh.
in an air supremacy role, but there where they could ship tanks and an unbelievable amount of men and material to any theater without worrying about port access or runways or any of that type of thing.
Well, the Russians are working on a very large heavy lift aircraft prototype now that would be able to disperse fighting combat units, I don't know how large, anywhere in the world in a matter of hours. So they're thinking the same kind of thing. A blimp would be a lot slower. I don't know what the payload potential would be, but both superpowers are thinking along the same lines, moving commanding amounts of men, arms, and equipment very quickly to any theater on the planet.
Well, that is key. I can tell you a lot of people when they look at the size of a military, they'll see, oh, that country's got a huge military. That doesn't mean generally very much in and of itself.
Well, look at Iraq. They had a million and a half man army, and they folded like a house of cards because of bribery, blackmail, and God knows what else that went on.
Well, that's the thing. Warfare occurs across many spectrums, and that is something DARPA excels at, is in terms of finding various ways to achieve dominance, whether it's the battle space, the psychological space, etc. But when it comes to getting your military into the fight, it's not how big it is, it's power projection capacity, and that's what costs a tremendous amount of money. For instance, in World War II, a decisive advantage the United States had over Japan was our, what they call UNREP, or underway replenishment, and that's an ability to use submarine tenders at sea to keep your submarines out without having to send them all the way out and all the way back, so they have increased station time to bring them fuel and mail and food and all arms, etc. So when it comes to, like, I can't speak to the Russians' latest program, but for instance, the whole idea of a large, what you would think of as a somewhat armored blimp, is it has huge payload at very low energy cost, because that's one of the things that we looked at, was reducing energy input requirements, because they're obscene. And the more energy you have to put into a system, the more resources you have to assign, and more energy you have to put into getting energy to the system, like 7 units of fuel to get 1 unit of fuel to a fighting unit. And one of the advantages of, say, something like a dirigible in this capacity is it's not fast, but unlike a ship, you're not strategically limited to coming in at a port, which means you don't bottleneck and no one can take out the port and then you're left. Well, now what do we do? You don't need to have runways, because that's another major issue where the Rapid Deployment Force and the Rangers, in particular 82nd Airborne, were created to seize air bases like Bandar Abbas in Iran in the in the planning of the 70s and 80s. In the event we ever had to get over there, we need to seize ports, airports, and then bring in heavy forces. If you could bring in significant and decisive heavy forces anywhere, no need to seize an airport, you could really pick your ground, and it becomes 10 times harder to defend a large battle space, not knowing where your opponent will settle in. Think like the Gulf of Incheon landings in Korea times everywhere, where, you know, strategic surprise and coming in behind a force and setting up a logistical base camp. Anyone who's a fan of the History Channel and sees how they had to plan D-Day, etc., if they could have picked their landing spots anywhere, not just beaches, not just these crossing points, come in over mountains and other strategic obstacles, it would be decisive. And while it's not my area of planning, what I used to study and what I used to do gave me some insight in this.
All right. Where do we want to go with our conversation on helping people understand what DARPA is all about? And we've done a pretty good job in the past of opening doors, showing decades. They work on a 30-year plan, pretty much, on most new weapon systems and concepts of materials, and they can actually be, I guess, applied to just geopolitical planning, that they have vast new ideas and concepts about how they want things to run, who's to run them, how they're to work out, and all the rest of it. Let's talk about geopolitics and DARPA. You mentioned tendrils. I've talked about the Mossad and AIPAC and having tentacles. I hadn't used the word tendrils, but that's even more insidious and does speak to the point very well. What about geopolitics and tendrils from DARPA? We know that the NSA today was busted for spying on Germany after they promised they wouldn't during the recent high points of the Greek crisis, which continue. That's not good. Europe is basically in a shambles right now.
Well, I don't know quite where the comment where I would come in on this, because I can't speak to the larger strategic issues.
No, I know. I want to make this clear. John was not working for DARPA. He was at a very high level conference and learned a lot just by virtue of who he is. And why he was invited there was because of who he is. That was quite a compliment. So we're just we're looking for information that is not necessarily something of a first-hand nature, but something that he can deduce and perhaps pull together by connecting dots that are out and about. So tell us about DARPA and geopolitics, if there is anything that you know of.
Well, the main thing would be to give the United States military the ability to influence pretty much any type of world situation, the technological capacity would be DARPA's aim. It's not an intelligence agency. It is not a military agency directly in terms of any military action. But what they try to do is look at the needs of the United States military and the projected needs, because it is very difficult to steer such a large organization, and it takes quite a lot of planning to give them the capacity, especially when they're looking at inventing entire technological capacities. And what they would do is they might look at a situation like Greece, and they would say, okay, are we going to intervene militarily, and how? And how would we prep the physical and psychological battle space to go in, and how would we deal with the civilian population, and is this going to be an aggressive intervention, a peacekeeping intervention? And they would develop a large number of scenarios, and they'd bring in experts like they had brought in myself, and they have an enormous amount of talent in-house. That's something that cannot be under or overstated, is the sheer capacity of talent that they already have at their disposal. And they would start developing plans to intervene. DARPA mm-hmm. would not be planning like an arm of the Pentagon to go into Greece directly. But what would happen in a place like Greece is they would start using capabilities already developed by DARPA. So, for instance, in the future scenarios we looked at, they may well look at something that popped in the news recently that I remember was bandied about at our conference, uh-huh. the large-scale use of calmatives, you know, in terms of suppressing crowds. And there's talk right. even of developing this capacity at home. And mm-hmm. that's something that I noticed is any mm-hmm. military capacity we develop, especially in the non-lethal or less-than-lethal mm-hmm. Environment or development of weapons, seems to get imported pretty rapidly into our domestic plans, which is a bit worrying. But that isn't the function of DARPA. DARPA develops the ability for our military and our existing militarization of our police gets it transferred from the Pentagon to domestic use. So how they would go into Greece, DARPA wouldn't have anything to do with that. But what would happen is the Pentagon would be accessing the plans. If they had to act tomorrow, the plans likely for tomorrow had been developed 20 years ago, maybe even proposed sooner. And they would then pick their array of options. And I guess it would very much depend on how hostile a welcome they received. You know, one of the things I remember about Greece and Turkey, both of them were NATO members. Both of them have almost come to blows in active war while members of NATO. And as a result, there's awful lot of tensions on the ground, less today than in the past. Mm-hmm. But you just never know what type of intervention will bring out. It tends to exacerbate every fault line, politically, socially, etc. There would be some aspects, for instance, in Greece that I know would welcome us and would welcome intervention as a sign of stability, probably in the upper echelons. There would be the mass of people who would obviously resent it. And it would be up to the military, and in particular, special operations, psychological operations, and civil affairs, to try and bridge those gaps and come up with a working solution. And you see a lot more of that these days as well, because, for instance, using the DARPA program I was part of, they looked at how can we access local information sources so it's not all dependent on what we can bring in. Can we convert existing biomass? What type of on the economy compromises can we make without negatively impacting, say, the local economy, you know, denuding them of assets that they need so we don't develop and arouse resistance in that area? And there are so many different factors that plug into this. As some of your listeners might know, Clausewitz is someone who said that war is politics by other means, and it quickly takes on a life of its own. So as a result, they don't. You're at one of these DARPA conferences or in one of their planning offices. You are not just looking at technological ramifications. You're looking at social ramifications, and they have a wide range of psychologists, sociologists of the highest caliber. And even the way they run their conferences, these people's expertise is brought into play to ensure maximum productivity, minimal social friction. And one of the things I mentioned the last time I was on the air was I've never been to any type of conference or organized event, military or civilian, in my career, past careers, where so many different people came together, quickly worked into productive teams, people who had never met each other, lack of social friction. So that's the type of expertise they bring in, that they really understand how to do these things and do them well. So the Pentagon, like I said, has a very large capacity to do this as in its own right. One of the big limits, though, is whenever you're working with young soldiers, you've got 18 to 24-year-olds, typically, sometimes older, but that's the prime age. These aren't necessarily people who have a wide and heavy grasp of the greater aims. They're cogs in a machine, just like I was when I was in the service, and they do their job within the limits of, you know, their adherence to orders and their own psychological makeup and maturity, etc. So DARPA and other organizations try and develop systems to mitigate this as well, so that if everyone is doing their job and is working in their own capacity to ideally their own ability, that the system smooths out individual discrepancies in performance.
Okay, very good.
Yeah, hold that thought.
Let's get an example or so on this when we come back in just a couple minutes. Talking with John about DARPA, one of the most secretive and certainly far-reaching agencies we have, and then some. Back in a minute. Okay, welcome back. Talking to John about DARPA. All right, John, go ahead. You have an example you want to give us. And I want to draw your attention to one of David D's all-time classic splash art pieces on the homepage at Rents. If this doesn't sum it up, I don't know what does. It's all there. Go ahead, John.
Well, the example I was going to give is how a system can impact the performance of an organization. Whereas at this DARPA event, these disparate people from across all walks of life, I don't think any more than any two or three of them had known each other other than the DARPA personnel themselves. We came together and we meshed as a team spectacularly. We were given a very quick psychological assessment, broken up into teams to ensure a wide variety not only of technical talents and disciplines, which was its own logistics task, but also that it was balanced by personality type to get a certain number of creatives versus organizers, people with value systems in an order of priority. And we were given color-coded badges, not only so they could see and make sure that we were in the right working groups, but that if you were talking to someone, you kind of understood how they processed their own thinking and you might perhaps accommodate that a little more intelligently than if you were to just, well, why isn't he getting this point I'm making? Well, it's because, well, I see that's the way he processes it from the little briefing we got. And it, like I said, I've never had an event move so smoothly. Conversely, an example just from my personal life is I recently had to move house. I'm not going to mention even the country I'm in right now. At every stage, the individuals I dealt with to restore or get broadband service operating were competent, concerned, and did their jobs. There was also a line fault, and it was we were trying to get that fixed in the weeks leading up to the move, and then the move affected where they turned off service at one end and the other. Everything that could go wrong went wrong. They didn't even communicate with my phone number correctly. They actually shut off the service right as the tech was there fixing the problem that resided in the telco cabinets across the street, the network interface card. I spent, knowing how these systems work and knowing how these people communicate and how their troubleshooting and escalation departments work as an insider, I did everything I could to try and make it as smoothly as possible. I probably spent 12 hours on the phone in the course of a month, burned out like God knows how many cell phone minutes trying to shepherd this process. Every time it looked like it was resolved, they screwed it up again. I'm still getting phone calls wondering why no one's home to arrange the move date when I'm already with another server. And it is a very large, otherwise well-funded organization, telecoms corporation. And like I said, the problem isn't that their people were incompetent or that they were unprofessional and unconcerned. Their system actually seems, from my understanding and talking to them and after a while getting curious enough to spend time talking to their management, their system defeats the best efforts of the parts working together. It'd be like if you tried to walk with your body, but your left leg didn't know if it should go forward or not. So it did whatever it could do best, but you found yourself face planting. And the thing with the DARPA organization is I'll tell you how they worked here, because I had mentioned that I would go into some of the scenarios. It did. This occurred right in February 2005, this event. It did occur to me very quickly that they were planning not just 30 years in the future, but I based some of my own proposals on the notion that they were looking for solutions to adapt now, like with some tweaking. And they had come down with several scenarios, what they called their 2035 scenarios, and it was a bit of strategic insight for the petroleum-free military. And they had the world situation, which is to provide a scenario for three working groups to use for their force development and how we were going to envision a military, changes to the table of organization and equipment, etc. They said the world has adapted to being petroleum-free. They did not tell us how. That was its own revelation that we talked about the last two times. They had Somalia in 2035, and they had Fallujah in 2035. Right. What that told me is that they were looking for ideas that they could cherry-pick today and for the future. They had briefings where, if any of your viewers are familiar with the Black Hawk Down scenario, those key operatives, they actually had planned to bring them to us, and something literally intervened at the last minute where the Mogadishu raiders, several of the key people that you would know their roles from the film, I don't remember the names, but they were supposed to show up and be part of this, and at the last minute they could not make it. But they did have the commanding officer of the Fallujah campaign, the first Fallujah campaign, there to discuss what went right, what went wrong, things that they would have liked and needed, things to affect psychological and physical battle space, sensors to develop, ideas for operating in terms of greater cultural sensitivity while not compromising military effectiveness, etc. They give us a set of scenarios and say, okay, how are we going to develop this? And like I said, some of this I could tell they were looking to adapt now based on the types of other briefings we got. You know, I talked about the helmet design that last time. But others, what they wanted to, when you're going to create a large-scale change in military organization, And they would give us briefings as to how much fuel was consumed, types of fuel, et cetera, for, moving ships, moving, a division, for instance, a heavy division versus a light one, just to give an idea of how big this logistical tail is. You get the notion of what you can start to do, the new capacities you can affect if freed of the petroleum requirement in the supply chain. And the example I think last time we talked about was the tooth to tail ratio. And the tooth is your fighting power versus the tail, which is your logistic train. Some of my ideas revolved around, and not just my ideas, but this is what I focused on for a significant portion, is using information systems more intelligently and in different ways to reduce operators on the front end. Because for every operator on the front end you reduce 10 support personnel, and then what you reduce is all the energy, fuel, and food requirements for 10 support personnel, plus all of the food and fuel and water it takes to move everything for those people. So I was looking for a more efficient way of using our existing forces. There's a lot of redundancy put in military operations of necessity, but it also leads to a lot of waste. And I could go into quite a lot of that, but the second of it is how a military, what we would call revolution military affairs, is enacted. You look at the Blitz,
Hold, John, hold on a
the
second, will you please? I'm sorry.
Germans
Just
didn't.
hold that thought. Talking about Blitz, and we have to take a break. We gotta do this 3 minutes. We'll come right back. So don't lose your thought. We'll continue. Okay, and we're back with John talking about DARPA. Okay, John, Blitz. I heard Blitz. I'm not sure if I heard Krieg, but I heard Blitz.
The example I was giving is the Blitzkrieg analogy, and I used it last time I spoke. The German military, in its highly effective Blitzkrieg campaign, had nothing that the Allies did not already have in terms of general equipment and capacities. In fact, if you were to look at the supply of tanks and artillery, etc., the Germans actually were outnumbered and frequently had lower quality equipment at the outset of the war than the Allies that they defeated. But what they did is they developed a doctrine to use their pieces together so that they were greater than the sum of the parts, operating what they would call with synergy, so that it would multiply effectiveness. And an example would be concentrating army at the Schwerpunkt, or the point, hard point of breakthrough, going in, effecting a breakthrough in significant force and penetrating deep into rear areas so as to smash the logistics, communications, etc., and leave the fighting forces withering on the vine without fuel and support, rather than the horrible and expensive attrition that is normally was experienced in World War I, where everything bogged down. And the success was obvious. At the onset of Operation Barbarossa, which took place, I think, 6 months later than had initially been planned, or 3 months, one of the two, they still captured more artillery pieces from the Soviets than the entire German military had in its arsenal. Everyone knows how they ran through the Low Countries and basically knocked the French out and Dunkirk, etc. And they actually could have done a lot more. The whole point is, they did. Everyone thinks, oh, well, they had these super tanks and all of that. No, the Tigers, the Panthers did not come online until later. They had perhaps an advantage in tactical support aircraft because they didn't develop a strategic bomber force to immolate cities like we and the British had. But the point is, DARPA tries to take a look at what the Germans did, for instance. The Germans operated...
John, excuse me. DARPA does study World War II Germany and German military tactics. That's interesting.
Well, they study any tactics. The point is, Germany, having lost World War I, became very introspective. Most militaries tend to fight the last war. But if you lost the last war, you kind of think about that a little bit differently. Whereas the United States military, conventionally, in like the Pentagon establishment, has been planning to fight a grand World War II, but with more modern weapons. And DARPA exists to try and avoid that, to take the introspection and redevelopment of a new military capacity without having to be defeated first. So they're always looking at scenarios to revolutionize what they need to develop, the way they need to think about what they develop, how they're going to use what they develop in a broad range of situations so that they actually can, say, have the success. What we called shock and awe, for instance, that was likely all down to what DARPA had done 20 years before. All the idea of a battlefield internet probably came about very quickly at the conception of ARPANET. Things like that. A lot of my projection capacity, or a lot of my proposals to project and develop capacity, I personally didn't say, okay, let's develop a new weapon, like, say, a whole bunch of mosquito submunitions, which some of our guys were actually had the invented the capacity to create those weapon systems in their own companies with their own patents. But I was thinking along the lines of, okay, How are we going to get forward and use our existing capacity now? How can we adapt our existing technologies, say, create a battlefield and battle net, battle space, flatten out the hierarchies to process information so everything happens quicker, etc. And my idea was, you could start adapting this today, and 30 years from now, you could have it down to an art and science. And that's why in quite a lot of our proposals, when the draft report came on, it had adapted a lot that I had put forward, and that I don't want to take too much credit here. Sometimes I proposed an idea, but no matter what happened in conference, other people immediately would work on refining that idea and expanding it. And other times, other people proposed an idea, and I was part of the group that would try and blend the direction we were going with refining their ideas. And that's why they didn't look to give anyone any particular individual credit. It was a very, no matter whose ideas came from what area, everything that came out of it was very much a collaborative effort. And I wouldn't have even thought along the lines that I thought of had I not been there getting the input of the people who were there. Mm-hmm. Quite a lot of what we talked about doing has since become a disclosed program. That's one of the reasons I'm willing to talk. I wouldn't have talked 2 years ago or 5 years ago, definitely not. But in the last 5 years, I've been regularly reading about, well, this is DARPA's next admitted program, like creating a pilotless, heavier-than-air vehicle that can loiter. I suggested using dirigibles that would be solar-powered, et cetera, but to use them as pseudo-satellites. Well, now that they're admitting that they're developing that capacity, and this is some years ago even, seeking competitive bids, I don't think it's that secret, and that just shows how quickly they started to act on some of these proposals. In other areas, I think they actually had hoped to go in these directions, but, you know, political organizations being what they are, they sought external validation to say, look, these experts came up with ideas that we had already proposed 6 months ago. Can we act on them today, you know, knowing how bureaucracies work? But I would tell you, DARPA is surely part of it's going to have the problems of any bureaucracy, but compared to any organization I worked in, private or public, I found it was perhaps the most effective organization in the world. And if I were to redefine my career goals, go back some years and make some plans, I would have had I heard about this organization years ago when I was young, which I heard nothing even of it, I would have likely looked to develop a career working in DARPA, not because I want to work on weapon systems, because if you look at a lot of what they do, the creation of the internet grew out of ARPANET. And an awful lot of what we are going to take for granted in the future is already being worked on by DARPA. I think it is perhaps the best use of tax funds at the federal level that exists within the military.
Yeah, that's quite a statement. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm not someone, I have not been involved with them at all since this conference. Certain developments in life have led me down other paths. But had they not occurred, had certain events and decisions, you know, to move abroad, et cetera, not occurred, I would have happily taken advantage of several offers to forward my resume into their circle, because I really believe very much in that role. And whereas philosophically, I am pretty opposed to almost everything the U.S. military has been tasked to do in terms of seeking a strategically offensive posture, wars abroad, militarizing police and you know, crowd control plans at home, et cetera. All of these things bother me very much. One thing that I can say is that would happen is if we could reduce our military expenditures and operations and just take, say, a tiny portion of the money we'd save on all the wars we're fighting, plow it into plans to leapfrog capacities. One generation hence, we'd have a highly effective, highly cost-effective military that is still the lead of the world, but without all of the expense, et cetera, because eventually this is the thing. You waste all of your funds on expensive wars and operations. That comes out of development for plans and procurement and research and development and future focus. It's hard, for instance, for the Pentagon to develop a grand future focus and maintain it when it is tasked with fighting multiple insurgencies and is breaking down and watering down its recruitment standards to keep the forces up and kept deployed in its equipment budget. You know, equipment gets combat lost and worn out abroad.
Yeah, sure.
So you know, I consider that a lot of what we are doing is taking away from what we will need to do in the future. And it's not about having a military that just goes and kicks everyone's rear end. What it is about having the capacity for a highly effective military. People understand, say, the stealth fighter. The stealth fighter was like near end-of-life obsolescence when it was first being used in Operation Just Cause in Panama and in the first Gulf War in Desert Shield, Desert Storm. This thing was not new. It had been operational for decades, and it had only been revealed publicly because it had crashed. A couple had crashed in short order, and they had to admit it. But they, when they were using it, it was already old tech. It was already replaced by something that none of us have heard of, even 20 years after it's already come into play.
Right.
And none of us know whether they're using it or holding it back. Even if you're special forces, even if you are in intelligence, because we compartmentalize. So none of us really know. And, you know, and say you have an advanced weapon system taking something out, the way it'll go in the planning processes, for those who don't know, is, oh, we had a spec ops team do it, not, say, a satellite-delivered kinetic kill weapon that dropped and impacted. I'm not saying that's what we have. I'm just saying that would be an example that you don't tell anyone we've got the capacity. So by the time the public's hearing about stealth fighters and getting caught up as to how high tech it is, it's already been in use. Mm-hmm. It's already been operational forever. And that's what we need. We need capacities nobody can plan against, because they're a surprise to most of our own forces as well as the enemy. And I would argue we need a philosophy of using these things in self-defense rather than intervention everywhere, but I'm not a policy planner. Nobody's asked me, you know, to contribute in that way.
Okay, very good. Stand by. We have to take a top of the hour break. John, and we'll come back and plow right into number two, hour number two, with John about DARPA.